I would say the bond market is in the process of taking the printing press away from the central banks. The game's over in terms of these central banks getting to get away with whatever they want. So that era of central bank omnipotence and the freedom to do whatever they wanted to do is now behind us.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. The global economy runs on credit, so when there's trouble in the credit markets, everything hangs in the balance. Bond yields have been rising fast around the world this year, so fast in some cases that things are starting to break. Just this past week, the UK credit markets started melting down, forcing the Bank of England to engineer a desperate rescue by buying £65 billion worth of gilts in the open market. How worried should we be about the instability in our credit markets here in the US? To find out, we talk with investor and analyst Bill Fleckenstein of Fleckenstein Capital. Bill, it's wonderful to see you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Hey, it's always a pleasure, and lots going on that I specifically want to talk with you about around bonds. Before we do, though, let me just kick this off at the high level like we normally do. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, I think from an economic standpoint, it's pretty clear that there's a dramatic deceleration. I mean, that's not going to surprise anyone. And, you know, we are in America on the brink of recession or in recession. You know, what's different in this particular go round is that nominal GDP is as high as it is because of the inflation component. And while real GDP is, you know, negative. So we're meeting the definition of the classic definition of recession or close to it. But I think you have to think about it differently or said differently. I think you can't be as confident about exactly how you think events may play out because of that component and the other things that are different about the cycle we're in right now, as opposed to the last one, which ended, you know, when all the subprime crap blew up. You know, the back end of the real estate bubble. This is not 08, in my opinion. 08 was a function of banks with razor thin capital, i.e. 3%, owning, you know, completely irresponsible amounts of garbage. And so their equity vaporized literally in a day or a week or whatever. And so 08, we had this massive domino effect, which, you know, got labeled contagion. In since then, the U.S. banking system has you know, almost three or four times the amount of capital in general, and that's one of the reasons we didn't get as much inflation as we should have out of the first round of QE, because our banks were busy doing other things. Of course, in Europe, they didn't do anything, and so that's why Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank are, you know, single digit midgets still. In any case, I think the financial system is got real problems. Anything more adverse coming out of the financial system is liable to make economies worse, because the economies are so have become so financialized, so to speak. I mean, the bubbles have driven the economies. The bubble certainly drove the economy in the 99 bubble and the 07-08 real estate bubble. That's when it burst. And the bubbles that have been created by QE and NERP and ZERP helped power economic activity. And with those going in reverse and all the capital that's been lost, the financial markets are going to add to the weakness in the economy. But I don't really think that's all that's that insightful. I mean, most people probably know that.
Okay. No, but it's a good jumping off point to where we're going. And one more sort of high level softball here for you. But what is your current assessment of the bond market right now?
Yes. Well, the bond market's gotten a lot more interesting since the last time we spoke.
Yep.
I would say the bond market is in the process of taking the printing press away from the central banks. That was certainly what, I mean, it's kind of started in Japan. And of course, Kuroda decided that he was not going to allow rates to rise and doubled down on yield curve control. And then the yen tanked. And now they're trying to intervene to stabilize the yen while they're trying to hold bond rates down, right? So they're the one process requires them to print money, and the other one would normally require them to tighten.
Right.
Because and it's very difficult to strengthen your own economy without tightening because you only have so much of other people's FX to sell, and most people can see that it's a bluff. The difference in Japan is because they've got Japan Inc. and Post, you know, they've got all these entities with so much capital in them, they can get away with moral suasion longer than you would be able to in a real capitalist economy. You know, that's more like cooperative capitalism, or I don't really know what you want to call it in Japan, but it's not the same as what we see in other places. So then when the bond market got thwarted, the FX market took over. So we've seen a little both over there. Obviously, the what just happened to the Bank of England, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. On the day they're scheduled to give a speech on quantitative tightening, they're back doing quantitative easing. They didn't call it that, you know, whatever they called the long bond rescue program or anti-fracture. Well, that's the ECB. In any case, the ECB will have the same problems because they're trying to keep the spreads from blowing out. But of course, now they hate Italy because Italy didn't go along with what the woke collective from the EU wants. And they had the nerve to vote in someone that didn't sing the party line.
Right,
So
elect more of a nationalist, yeah.
there will be, you know, more problems in the ECB land. I mean, the Fed looks so good because they're being compared to the biggest mental midgets on the planet. And so to the Fed's credit, they've hiked, you know, over 300 basis points, and they've talked a good game, and they look so good by comparison. I have no doubt that they will fold when some real trouble begins. Exactly what that will be, I don't know. And obviously it will take more pain. Or they could back off incrementally. You know, if we get a couple pieces of data, like today when we're having this interview, the ISM data was a teeny bit less. And of course, everybody took that and ran with it, trying to think that, well, maybe they'll be less hawkish. You know, the market's kind of exploded this today. And I think that's for accommodation reasons, not just that. But in any case, the game's over in terms of these central banks getting to get away with whatever they want. So the era of central bank omnipotence and the freedom to do whatever they wanted to do is now behind us, and we're going to go back to a period that was sort of like prior to when Volcker broke the back of inflation. You know, so it's going to look more like the 70s or late 60s. We'll see, you know, more stop-go economic activity and things associated with that. So, I think that's the best way to sum it up. I mean, I don't think the Fed is due all the credit it's given for what's happened in the bond market here in America. I think a large part of it was the bond market itself just voting with its feet. And then every time it voted with its feet, they'd say, aha, they're pricing in more Fed hawkishness, and they give all the credit to the Fed. So the only credit the Fed gets is that they have in fact raised rates rather aggressively, but you know, no one ever talks about the reason that so much damage has been done on 300 basis points, which is a lot when you're coming from zero.
Right.
Is the fact that they created these massive bubbles and they insisted on rooting for inflation and all the things they've done irresponsibly for 25 plus years gets ignored. I don't know if they're going to continue to get away with that. I sure hope not. But anyway, so that's where we are.
Okay. Well, you got a lot in there that I want to dig into. In particular, your comment there about it sort of game over, where the markets are taking the printing press away, the bond market's taking the printing press away from the Feds here.
It's in the process. It hasn't taken it yet. It's working
Okay.
out.
Right. But they're not using the printing press right now. So, correct. You know, maybe it starts just growing cobwebs from here.
Except in Japan and in England, they still are, even though they've got these problems. But yes.
Yeah. So let's get to England in just a second, because that's a fascinating one. And that's one where actually monetary and fiscal policy are colliding at the moment. Right.
Monetary policy is colliding with itself over there, too. But anyway.
Okay. I just recorded an interview with Pedro da Costa, who spends his entire career just focusing on, you know, talking to central bankers and following them. And he echoed some comments that Lacey Hunt, who is a, you know, former senior Federal Reserve economist, have made, which is in alignment with what you're saying here, Bill, which is they're saying that the era of QE may be ending, at least for the Fed, where maybe they continue to use it selectively as an emergency liquidity option, but in terms of using it as a form of stimulus to goose the economy, that may be ending here. It's created repercussions that, you know, Pedro is saying that even the central planners themselves are saying maybe it actually was more trouble than it was worth, but obviously, you know, now the bond market is telling central banks all around the world, hey, you know, we're, you create too many issues when you do that. And therefore we're kind of, as in your words, trying to take it away from you with these higher rates. So, but before I get there, I kind of have a series of questions I want to try to churn through if we can. The first one just being, and maybe we'll get to your answer as we address some of these questions, but in your earlier appearances on this channel, you have said the real threat to investors, probably the system in general, but to investors who watch this channel, the real threat that they need to watch out for, that's going to arrive when there's quote unquote trouble in the bond market.
Right.
How do things rate on the trouble scale right now to you?
Well, that's why the central banks can't back off the tightening. So let's say the Fed. You know, the reason the damage has been so severe in the stock market is because the Fed can't back off. The Fed didn't have its hands tied at any time, you know, really have since the late 80s. You know, the markets have trusted the Fed and the central banks. I don't think they should have, but they have.
Right.
And thus, in the hiking cycle we saw in the 2000-ish and in 07-ish, the Fed was doing it itself, albeit slowly. So they could have stopped in the bond market and everything would have rallied. They didn't. But now I think if they stopped today, because they've gotten everyone so on the other side of the boat, you'd get a big rally, but I don't think it would stick. And so the game has already changed, but it's not complete, right? I mean, because if it was complete, you know, Japan couldn't get away with what they're doing. The Bank of England couldn't get away with it. You know, the ECB is not going to get away with whatever the wiggle they're going to come up with. And, you know, the first time the Fed backs off a notch, there's going to be a huge rally. It's going to take some time for people to understand that the 20 years that they've learned how the market works, the last 20, say, is obsolete. It's not working that way. That doesn't mean the central banks won't try to do the same thing, but it's just not going to work, because inflation is going to be with us to enough of a degree that it'll be lurking in the background. And eventually people are going to see that they can't pursue the policies that would be required to really try to snuff it out. And I don't, you know, we've gotten away with too much mismanagement for so long. All the can kicking of the monetization that's gone on for 20, 25 years, the can kicking, which is meant to buy time, never resulted in fixing anything other right. than we did recapitalize the banking system. I mean, for real. And so we did get that done. But this cycle's problem is not going to be in the bank system, at least not in America, could be in Europe. But it's also going to be about government solvency. You know, that's kind of what happened with Bank of England. That's what's going to happen to the ECB. We're going to have our turn in the barrel at that at some point as well, because people are going to start looking at the interest on the debt and all of that. We, because the problem, people have had their eyes on problems elsewhere. We've gotten away with A lot of our problems without getting penalized for them yet, but I don't think that's a permanent state.
Okay. That's a great jump off into this list. So maybe first question here, can the economy sustain a federal funds rate above 4%?
Good question. I'm not sure. Again, it ought to be able to, but I don't know how we'll be able to do. It's, well, this is a little bit of an unprecedented period because all of QE was unprecedented and it went on for so long. I mean, you know, we had an interlude where they did some QT and they raised rates, then they gave up. So now we've got this high nominal growth. It's a function of inflation to a large degree. At 4% funds rate, some things are going to be impacted badly. I think a little bit depends on what happens in the financial markets, how fast that level of interest rates may impact things. But I don't want to be, I don't think it's possible to be as dogmatically certain on some subjects as I often think I can be. Doesn't mean I'm right. I'm not really too sure. I kind of don't think so. But again, I think it's going to be the financial markets which will scare the Fed more than the economic data.
Okay, but so let me give two things that result from rates that high. One is you have the percentage of the of corporations out there, and I've heard estimates from 20 to 30% that are quote unquote zombie corporations, right? That have been getting by.
Sure.
On a cheap cost of capital, right? And now the cost of capital is a lot more expensive, right? So there's the potential failures in that part of the market. And then the other one, which people have said, hey, this is actually the really big thing to worry about. This gets to your point about sort of like, a national solvency is when the cost of servicing the national debt goes up as dramatically as it should, given the rates on treasuries and how fast that they're going up, you get to a point where we have a really hard time meeting our debt service payments as a nation, especially if we're going into recession and tax receipts go down at the same time.
Right. Well, I think the real question is, can the financial markets handle a 4% funds rate?
Okay. Or how about, just the system? You pick where you want
know,
the system.
I don't know that they can, and that feeds back into the economy. So I think the economy itself, like if by some miracle the stock market rallied for the next few months, then I think maybe the economy could handle it. The stock market tanks? No, it can't. So remember, the stock market is kind of the economy. It's gotten so big and out of control that I think it matters more than the economic than the economy at. In terms of judging what might happen next, I think.
Okay, let me throw one more, or let me kick out one additional leg of the table and see what you think. So with the rising of interest rates, mortgage rates have to go up just mathematically, right? And they have gone up a lot already, right? Mortgage rates are basically around 7% now, right? They were at, we're talking average 30-year fixed. They were under 3 a little over a year ago, right? So that's a dramatic increase. Do you have any level of concern about that just in general for the system? But also, as home prices come down, and they should for a myriad of reasons, but just basically they should from simple math, right? And mortgage rates go up, prices have to come down to adjust. Mortgage rates have gone up pretty dramatically, may go up even further. Houses have to come down to adjust. The negative wealth effect from that is much greater than what happens in the financial markets because stocks aren't that commonly owned. You know, what is it? 90% of all financial assets are owned by the top 10% of households, whereas, two-thirds of households own their home, right? So if housing prices come down, that has a much greater impact on consumer spending, which is like 70% of GDP, right?
Yep. So. At the margin, And obviously it's worse if you have floaters like they might in Great Britain, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. And so, you're talking about floating mortgages, but yeah.
Yeah. But by the same token, anybody that raced and bought a house, even if they paid a boatload over the offering price during the mania of the last couple of years, if they tied up their financing anytime less than about 6 or 8 months ago, then they're going to maybe be congratulating themselves on they got a mortgage that's at 3 or 4 instead of 6 or 7. So, you know, are they going to mark themselves to market because their house bounces around? Possibly, could be. But, you know, it's like I say, it's just not so clear, you know, because if they can service, you know, they obviously can service the debt at the lower price, and the higher price doesn't impact them. Now, it's going to impact transactions and it'll impact prices at the margin.
Yep.
But I think the psychological effect for houses might not be as important right now as perhaps the stock market.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know. I'm guessing it, but
no, I know, but we're asking you for your opinion, and you're a guy who's been around the block a long time here. So it's got high weight. All right. So let's go to the Bank of England right now, because I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's the kind of trouble in the bond market that you are, when you say trouble in the bond market, that's a really good example of what it looks like, right? Is where you have, sort of like a melt up in yields that, you know, if unchecked, would just sort of cascade through the system.
They can't even try to convince themselves that the market was following the Bank of England. The market just did what it did, and particularly reacted negatively to the budget. And then because of the prior period of insanity brought on by the central banks, caused people to reach for yield. And then, so while some people are quick to say, well, then it serves them right. Well, yeah, I guess. But if you were trying to be prudent in that period and you were running a business or running an entity that has long-tailed liabilities, like a pension plan or an insurance company, and you tried to be disciplined and said, this is crazy, I'm not going to participate, you know, you had a big gap into what your funding needed to be. And if you tried to be prudent, they might have kept you on for 6 months, if that long. And then they fired you and they would have got somebody who was going to swing for the fences.
Right.
Like the CalPERS down in your state, you know, has packed itself with, you know, LBO stuff. I mean, we call it private equity now. And venture and all these. So all kinds of speculative risky behavior took place as a consequence of no one being able to get paid for their savings. And they still aren't paying you vis-a-vis inflation. You know, I'm so sick of hearing about the bond market's prediction of real yields. Market predictions are never worth much at inflection points. At high points, the market thinks everything's going to be great forever. And at low points, it thinks the opposite. Forever. So now the market's kind of sanguine about the market's opinion of inflation is pretty sanguine or less sanguine. It bounces around and people act like that's a legit measure. It just blows me away. Look at the level of inflation today. Ask yourself, do you think the policies we're pursuing are going to make a dent in it in a serious way? It'll dent it some. How much? You have to think about it that way. You can't just say, well, the market thinks, well, the market's not thinking. They're just backing into that number as a consequence right. of where rates are. So, we're gonna have a prolonged period of negative real rates, just like they are now. So, you know, back to your 4% question on cash or funds rate. If the funds rate got there and banks were offering a commensurate rate, you know, that you'd be able to get some number between 3 and 5 with short dated paper. Would you want to take that? Well, it's better than zero. So for just cash, that's fine. But, you know, does that really compensate you for the level of inflation? No, it's better than what you were getting. So, you know, in other words, that level of rates that we're talking about matters compared to the level of inflation and opportunities that are out there. So it's I'm back to the part about explaining why it's a kind of a tricky mix. Having said that, there are going to be lots of dead bodies and or entities that got that we'll see that got hurt for this stretching for yield income appreciation in pension funds and in various other places. You know, there's a lot of marks that are going to have to be fixed in the private arena. In other words, where venture capital and private equity is marked at one place, then it's really way different. So there's a lot more shoes to drop in what's happened here that aren't marked to market on a daily basis in the stock market or the bond market.
All right. So two questions I want to ask. I'm trying to figure out which one to ask first. The big question that everybody is asking is all right, Bill, if that's the kind of trouble that you're worried about in the bond market, and we've just seen it in the UK, does that make you feel, you know, more nervous that we're going to see it here in the US at some point soon? I think you've already kind of answered that, which the answer is sort of, yeah, it will. We just don't know what the trigger is going to be at this point in time, but you can, you think it's a preview of what's to come here.
Yeah. I just think our bank system is way better than Europe's, but right. but in terms of people acting badly because of the incentives and the environment created by the central banks, you know, we're humans just like they're humans in Europe and in everywhere else. Right. I mean, so it's the same sort of excess risk-taking, which is going to be exposed by the tide going out, you know, will have taken place here too. We just haven't seen much of the damage yet.
Okay. So you know, there's human stupidity. I'm going to go back to the England story for a second. There's a lot of human stupidity on display there. One of which is you had the Bank of England stepping on the brakes saying, look, you know, we're tightening, or you know, we're raising rates. Now we're just about to start quantitative tightening. And then the new prime minister said, well, I'm going to do a fiscal stimulus, you know, package through tax breaks, and they're going to be funded by debt. We just haven't figured out how yet. Right. And that was the trigger that caused the meltdown. Right. But what made it worse, as you're saying, is because market players had been so starved for safe yield that everybody just stretched, you know, for yield they shouldn't have been. And of course the pension funds were buying collateral on margin. And when this thing blew up, they were horrendously vulnerable to it, right? So so anyways, human stupidity is going to be part of the mix here. We need to count on that. That's definitely what I'm hearing from you loud and clear. But what's interesting about this...
Sorry, just let me be clear, though. Yeah. I mean, yes, it's part of it is the environment that the central banks created, you know, because... If right. you have an assumed rate in your pension plan of, you know, 7 or 8 or 6 or some other number, or your insurance company, you need that. And fixed income yields are, you know, like a quarter of that, you know, it's going to create, people are going to do what they got to do to get to their bogey, because the ones that won't do it early on will get fired and replaced by the ones that will do it.
Right.
So it's, yes, individuals made mistakes. Individuals made mistakes in our real estate bubble. But that was a little more on them because they didn't have a gun at their head. Well, I got to have this yield. I'm not excusing the bad behavior we're going to find out, but I'm trying to make sure that the real enemy and culprit in this was the central banks and the governments.
I completely agree. And that's sort of what I was talking about with human stupidity, which it's the malinvestment that they created, right?
But the real bogeyman, the central banks and the governments, not the individuals.
Individuals
behaved badly, but you're supposed to hold the people in charge to a higher standard than the average individual who may not know much about financial markets. Now I'm talking about professionals when I'm talking about the other thing, but anyway.
Yeah, I'm there with you. And sorry, I misspoke. I didn't mean to say malinvestment, although of course that's what happened. It's the malincentive. The central banks were setting these malincentives that the market participants, to your point, kind of understandably followed, right? But they were bad incentives to be, you know.
Yeah, if you've been investing for 5 or 10 years, you would have thought, I got some experience. I kind of know what I'm doing. But your experience has all been in the QE era.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't want to get too much down that rabbit hole.
That's okay. Well, and we're in violent agreement here, which is basically, you know, poor decision-making, poor policies, poor incentives is what kind of created this. And then of course, you know, that leaves you vulnerable to stupid decisions like the, you know, lobbing a a surprise tax cut out of the middle of nowhere to stimulate when the central bank's out there trying to tighten at the same time. So, but what I think is so interesting for you about what happened in the UK is, last time you were on, you said, look, if the Fed pivots before it has gotten inflation under control, if I remember correctly, you said that you think that that is the moment it was going to lose the bond market, that the bond market was going to lose faith in the Fed and say, you've just proven you can't get inflation under control. We're now going to take rates higher from here, whether you want it or not, because we don't believe in you anymore. We want to be compensated for the higher degree of risk going forward. That might have just happened in the UK, right? Where basically the Bank of England was forced to go back to easing. I don't know if they're going to be able to do quantitative tightening now. They may have just learned the limits of, hey, we can't tighten anymore, folks, because if we do, we're going to bring our entire pension system and then probably a bunch of other things down with it.
Yeah, well, then the currency is going to collapse.
Yeah, and that's the price you pay, right? The currency. Yeah, but my question to you is, do you feel that the Bank of England just hit that point that you think the Fed could hit if it pivots too early, where the bond market is going to give up on the Bank of England?
Yes, but what it also illuminates is this is a process. It's not like, okay, one day it's one way and the next day
right.
It's the other way and never to go back. I mean, the pound hit 105, or actually a little lower, a week ago, and now it's up to, 113. And I haven't checked. Let's see where gilts are today. Did you happen to look? Do you know?
I have not looked at gilts, no.
Hang on. So they're at 394. They got up to like 450. So the knee-jerk reaction was that this little gambit worked, you know? Now, Draghi got away with this back in 11, or was it 11, right around there, with his famous, we'll do whatever it takes.
Bazooka speech, yeah.
Huh?
His bazooka speech,
yeah. Yeah. And all he had to do was bluff. He got away with it. I don't think they're going to get away with that in England. I mean, so we haven't seen the last of the consequences of this. I don't think people have sat down and said, really thought through, okay, wait, they can't really tighten. We've got plenty of inflation. We got a weak currency. Since it can't do this, our currency is going to get weak again. I mean, the problems, I don't think, have been sorted there. Now, but for all we know, 103 on the pound was low enough vis-a-vis their problems compared to other problems. Because remember, these currencies are not like, it's not like we got great choices. It's not like you're going to a place where they make, handmade ice cream and you got nothing but great choices. It's the opposite. You got nothing but bad choices, and it's who's the least bad. So, I mean, they can't get away with what they're trying to get away with. I just don't know, what's the interlude going to be? I mean, the Bank of Japan can't either. I mean, they spent $20 billion. They moved the yen from 145 to 142, and now it's back to, I think, 145-ish. Yeah, 140. Yeah, almost. So these are processes. They'll take a little while. So, and also, like, if you look at the Fed, the fact that rates got to where they did, I think, in addition to people selling them and the bond market backing up on its own, a lot of people piled in on the short side. So if the yields get stretched enough and enough players are on the wrong side, the Fed comes in and does something you might think is not going to work in the long run, like what the Bank of England did. But in the short run, it works. So people think, oh, well, maybe it wasn't how we thought it was in the first place. Just like right now, you could say, well, maybe the Bank of England's going to get away with it. I don't think that they are. But, on the other hand, maybe the pound does okay and rates go up slowly. I don't know how it's going to exactly play out. But I do know it's a process. And so if the Fed were to say on tomorrow that they're going to back off a little bit and, they're going to say something innocuous like, we're going to pay close attention to the data. If it shows real weakness, we might slow down our pace. I think you'd get a huge rally. I don't think it would stick.
Last,
but you'd get a huge rally. Somewhere as you go through that process, at some point when they say that, they get the opposite. And when that happens, that's when it's officially taken away. So we haven't gotten to the taken away part. We're in the taking away part, and it could take quite a while to play out. We just have to see because of how events unfold. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense. I got to imagine, though, for the UK, what just happened was an important milestone in that process.
Absolutely.
Where the market realizes, okay, these guys actually can't control inflation at this point because okay. All right. So a few more questions on bonds, and then I want to get to another big topic. So I'm just asking you to pontificate here. Where do you see yields going from here in general? Let's look out for next year.
For the next 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 months.
Yeah,
let's
say a year.
I think there's some chance that, you know, today there's a big rally in the stock market and the bond market. I think part of it had to do with the pressure that we saw at quarter end in the other direction. Maybe it got overdone for now. And there was this little scrap of data that looks like maybe the Fed will be slightly less hawkish. So I think in the very short run, there could be a rally. You know, I mean, if you'd have talked to me on Friday, Ted said the world was coming to an end. And today I'm saying, man, maybe not yet.
Yeah.
I think rates, you know, could see a bit of a rally here for a little while. I think that, you know, a year from now, I think a lot depends on the stock market. See, I don't really think the stock market can hold up. I think we're at a really interesting juncture because the macro environment has soured in a way that almost everyone can see it now. You know, sometimes the macro environment, nobody knows anything. The average person now, I mean, even the average investor, I think, knows a lot about all the macro problems.
Mm-hmm.
And what we saw in the last quarter was a little taste of companies saying, maybe our margin estimates and our earnings estimates are too high. And big companies like Target and Walmart and FedEx, you know, dropped in amounts that used to only happen to, you know, speculative little companies. Of course, they went up in a way that only used to happen to speculative little companies. Well, right. That's a different issue. So I think the earnings season is going to be particularly ugly. I think a lot of expectations are too high for margins and for earnings. I think that the strength of that we've seen in the dollar is going to hurt companies that have an international exposure, which is a lot of the big tech stocks. So I think we're in a situation where the macro environment's pretty sour, although maybe the bond market's going to stop going down for a few weeks. And if we start having tape bombs repeatedly, that'll feed on itself. And so what we need to see is what's the level of damage that this earnings season is going to do to the stock market. I think some companies are going to get hit pretty hard. And we'll have to see if by some miracle they don't get hit that hard and we get a little data that shows a little softening in the economy, which we will, and inflation ticking down a bit, which we will. And then the Fed says, you know, maybe we don't have to be so tough. You could get a period in here where the market might do better than people think in October in earnings season. And then you could have a rally that maybe goes into, you know, the end of the year, next year. I don't know. On the other hand, that the earnings reports could be, you know, awful enough, and the positioning could be that the market gets splattered. You know, I think that's more likely, but I know that it's possible that the other scenario I gave you is possible too. And if you're going to be a practitioner of this and operate on your opinions, you have to know what can go wrong with your scenario. So since I was pretty aggressively short last week, and I'm not right now. I covered quite a bit between yesterday and this morning. I got lucky this time. My plan is to get aggressive as we get ready to get into earnings season. So I'm kind of hoping the beginning of the calendar flows and last week's positioning provide a rally. And then maybe this later in this week, I can start putting on positions again to get short for tape bombs. But I want to acknowledge the fact that the scenario I gave you, maybe it won't be bad enough, and maybe somehow the market can get off the hook and struggle through here without a big, you know, another waterfall decline. I think the high probability event is another waterfall decline when we break the lows of you know, that we set recently. But I'm alive to the fact that it might not happen. And so I probably sound rather even-handed, but my belief is it's going to get ugly, but I know that there's a way out for them for the short run. Maybe the elections will have an impact. You know, they haven't really impact. You know, when Trump got elected, a lot of people thought the world was going to end and the stock market didn't. And when Biden got elected, I think a lot of people thought the world was going to end and it hasn't. Well, I mean, it subsequently did, but not because of him yet. So I don't know if the election throws a curveball or, you know, that could matter. Anyway, I'm kind of getting off the tangent there.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, and then we're going to, you're taking it in the direction I want to go in. Just for people, to make it clear to people, can you more directly tie why tape bombs and a really disappointing earnings seasons for equities, you know, it's obviously that's going to create stock price drawdowns. Why do you think that would exacerbate bond yields any more so than just the Fed's continued hiking here or any other factor?
Well, because you've been able to make a lot of money for a long time in the stock market, a decade-ish, maybe longer, but not really understanding.
Right, by throwing darts.
Yeah, I mean, meme stocks being the classic example, but there's plenty of multi-billion dollar companies that are unprofitable, have crummy businesses. No, I mean, they might be okay for this 5 minutes, but they don't have any barriers to entry. So what happens is when companies start getting hammered, I mean, big companies, household names, it alerts people to the fact, hey, this too can happen to you. And when the companies tell you, hey, this problem exists and that problem exists, and then people see that, oh, the margin expectations are too high and they're not going to go, the earnings are not going to be what I thought they were down the road. They're going to be something less than the value you pay that you've been paying is too high. It gets to be kind of contagious. You know, the first couple people will ignore the first couple of tape bombs, and then it starts to matter. You know, it starts to spread. And you know, it reminds folks that they aren't just pieces of paper, that they're fractional interests in businesses and they're tied to something. And I think a lot of people have just been able to play, oh, these are pieces of paper and they're all fun, kind of now. People have been a little disabused of that in the recent months. But so I think that earnings season will matter. And you know, it's off. When you're not in earnings season, you know, my friend Fred Hickey and I used to call it the no news period, right? And with no news, you can believe anything you want. And then the news rains in over and over and over. Expectations too high, and they beat you down. And then the market has the momentum, kind of like what we just saw in the last month. There was a little momentum to the downside. And so that can feed on itself as well.
Okay. But from a bond yield standpoint, I can understand that corporate bond yields yields go up there because people are more worried about the companies just staying in business. Do you see any sort of potential bifurcation where the corporate bond yields may go up, but people might start seeking safety in treasuries and government bonds?
I don't know that they'd be thinking, if they were going to seek safety, they'd probably go shorter dated. But what you could see is, what we didn't see in the last month when the equity market got weak, it didn't help the bond market at all. Usually equities get weak and bonds rally because people think, okay, now that, you know, the Fed's going to back off. People haven't been able to make that story because they believe the Fed's committed. So if we get into a bunch of tape bombs, people are going to think, okay, it's going to be more likely now that people will think that maybe the Fed will back off because the Fed's already done a number of hikes, right? And so if weakness in the very short term could lead to a little more strength in the bond market. So I think over the next month or two, and I think the economic data could show some deceleration, maybe we'll get a decent bit of inflation data. I mean, it's going to come down on, you know, because, but it does, it's not going to go back to where they want it. So I think in the short run, the weakness in the equity market or the economy will lead to a stronger bond market. We're not to the point. People believe the Fed. They believe the Fed is going to be tough. They believe the Fed. They believe the Fed when they say we're going to conquer this. Now, I don't think they should, and I can explain why, but I don't think that's relevant right now. So they believe in the Fed. So if the data suggests that the Fed can back off, because then folks will believe it, and so you can get the bond market being a little more friendly, you know, for what, a month, 2 months, 3 months, something like that. And the real danger period is going to be after we get through here, when the markets have done, let's say we get to December, and then people start to understand that inflation's really not going to be solved by the Fed. Become a combination of they can't really do what they could do if they knew exactly what to do, and the massive government debts. So anyway, I think we're in a little interlude period to some degree, mostly because I think the stock market is going to be probably pretty weak.
Okay. And I want to get to your market outlook. And I got some questions right around that. I hate to do this, but because you just mentioned it, I do want to dig into the point you just made. So it sounds like you are skeptical that the Fed is going to get inflation under control. I'd love to understand why, and I want to posit a question for you to react to as you answer. I've been hearing the question asked recently, hey, there's so many disinflationary and outright almost deflationary forces that are pulling at the economy right now. Slowing economic growth, correcting housing market, compressing corporate profits. We could get into layoffs, which would make things even worse if consumer spending gets further compromised by all that. The Fed has tightened. We haven't, because there's a delay in Fed policy hitting the real economy, we haven't felt the impact of some of the more recent big jumps that the Fed's made in interest rates. The impact of that's still to come. So there's sort of two questions around that. One is like, will inflation kind of resolve itself if the Fed were, almost to do nothing from here? And then secondly, let's say the Fed pivoted too soon, quote unquote, before CPI is back at 2. If the Fed pivoted, even if it went back to quantitative easing, would that really drive the CPI back up higher? Because it really didn't in the past 10 years of lots of monetary stimulus from the Fed. It really wasn't until fiscal stimulus came into the picture that we saw the CPI go bananas and we had the supply chain shortages. So is inflation a big long-term worry here?
Yeah, I think so. Because now we can't prove this. So QE, in my belief, look, probably half the market, some people believe this and other people will argue the opposite side. So I already know that. My belief is you print money like QE. I know Lacey Hunt will say, well, you didn't really print money. I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to say, when you do QE and you increase the quantity of money, look, you take $4 trillion, throw it in the economy. You think prices are going up or down? Now, what prices go where is a function of who got the money that you threw. Right. If it all landed at Adam's house, well, then you'd have your own plane and you'd have nicer wine and you'd have you'd fix your gym in the garage and build another one.
Right.
It depends where the money goes, partly as to what prices move. All right. But it's not possible to argue that you could put all this money in there and it has no inflationary consequences. Sometimes the inflation is in financial assets. Sometimes it's in art, but that money goes somewhere. And it leaks into the economy as well. What happened in the post real estate bubble, let's not call it the great financial crisis because that's not what it was. So it's a real estate bubble that burst, and the great financial crisis takes the blame away from the Fed and the regulatory agencies who deserve the blame.
Okay.
But in the wake of that, the legislation that got passed, the banks weren't able to lend as they ordinarily would have. So I believe that had a large part in terms of keeping inflation more in check. Now, inflation wasn't really 2 like they said.
Right.
But it was higher. But it wasn't higher enough relative to the money people were making in financial assets and real estate. So nobody cared. Then, because they got away with it and they don't understand anything, the central banker said, well, we'll just do more. And the Fed monetized all kinds of stuff they'd not monetized in the past. They stayed with QE longer than they ever should have. They were cheering on inflation. They were talking about making up for past inflation. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had this, they even convinced themselves that it was part of their mandate to create inflation, which right. It's not.
Right. And they said in like 19 or whatever, like, we'll let inflation run a little hot for a little while.
Yeah, and no problem. We'll get it under control. Well, yeah. When you have misallocated as much capital as they have in the last decade, and you've trained people to behave in a certain way, like these fixed income people that had no fixed income but had liabilities to meet, you modify their behavior and you modify everyone's behavior. To really break the back of the inflation psychology, it's not just that inflation has changed. And yes, it was a combination of QE and fiscal policy. But because of the QEs that came before, we trained the politicians to think that there's no limit to what they can do. And so they came with these stupid fiscal policies on top of everything else. And there were no adults in the room. No one stood up. I mean, there were some, you know, there were people like myself and other people in the financial markets said, wait, you can't do this. But nobody listened. And so we created this massive, massive speculative bubble and mentality. Meanwhile, in the last few years, we've changed how people think of inflation. They can see that there's such a thing as shortages. Nobody really experienced that in any meaningful way before COVID. And these supply chains that have been corrupted and the problems in China and the relationship means they're going to be redone. But and we also found out that we were running a razor thin just in time inventory for everything.
Highly efficient, very brittle.
And now that's snapped. And now there are some things where we need more CapEx to fix energy. We need more CapEx. You know, we spent all these trillions of dollars on green and we got Zippo from it in terms of energy output, more misallocated capital. But there's no money going in to produce more of the things that are like on a fine balance, right? And the fact that the energy complex has gotten as strong as it has, ex the recent decline, you know, people have forgotten. We all knew this in the 80s because we'd seen the 60s and 70s, even though I was kind of young in that part of it. You realize that energy goes into everything. You got a box of Kellogg's cornflakes. Well, how much energy went into that? You know, the making of it, the transporting, the manufacturing, energy's in everything. So that's now it's down some and we've already experienced that. But psychology, I believe, has changed and it's gotten to the wage chain. People can see that we've gotten, that they can get bigger wage settlements than they have. And so it's kind of contagious there too. So they are not going to get the inflation genie back in the bottle, barring a legit, you know, depression kind of environment collapse. It's going to take something to really scare the hell out of people to change that psychology. They're not going to be willing to take that pain. It's easy to talk tough when the markets are still behaving. I mean, the financial authorities wouldn't consider September behaving, but they can act tough like they don't care because not enough damage. But the Bank of England was talking a good game too, weren't they? They were going to have a speech on quantitative tightening on the day they're forced to buy long gilts.
Right.
So these central bankers, they don't know how their policies work. If you just look at the speeches of these knuckleheads, you can see it. And so they don't know how it works. They talk tough. They'll fold for sure when the right kind of damage comes along and or they get a little bit of a downtick in inflation or enough economic weakness. I don't know exactly what that's going to be. And I'm not saying they're going to go to saying, okay, we're not going to hike anymore, but they're going to show some sign of, okay, maybe we've done enough for now and see how it plays out. They are not going to be willing to take the medicine. And remember, when Volcker was able to break the back of inflation, a lot of CapEx had gone into the 70s to chase these, you know, commodities and things were on that side of things that caused inflationary pressures. We're not doing that.
We're not doing that now.
ESG won't let you. Yeah. So I think we're going to see a change in leadership in the market of the kind of things that do well and capital will go into those areas and things like that, but that's another step away.
Yeah. And the problem too is the return you see from those capital investments is measured in, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. So no matter how much money we throw at it today, we're not going to see the benefit of that for a good while.
No, how about ever?
Maybe ever, yeah. And talking to guys, you know, who were big in this space, you know, Rick Rule is a good example. And he just says, look, we are 10, 15 years of underinvestment that we're still going to be feeling the impact of for a good long while here. So the hits are going to keep on coming in the meanwhile, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Look, I could so dive with you further on that topic for hours, but we got to wrap things up here. Let me get to the last main category, which is your market outlook. So it sounds like you're pretty bearish. You've said a couple of times that you, if I got it right here, quote, it's going to get ugly. So I'd love to get a sense, a more clearer sense of what you think might be in store. As you answer that, let me ask this one question. You, last time you were on, we had a fascinating conversation where you described the giant mindless robot of,
passive
capital that has been driving the indices up as capital has come into the markets, just from a mathematical basis. And that's what's been supporting all the FANGs and everything like that. And I remember asking you, as you described how it works in terms of pushing the indices up, that I imagine it works the same in reverse, right? And you said, yes. And we're not there yet. But what's interesting is, you know, Apple, world's most bulletproof stock, you know, was down 10% in September.
And I know it was a big position for me.
Okay.
On the short side.
On the short side. Well, congratulations. Yeah. So I guess, can you give us an update on the giant mindless robot? And are we approaching potentially, could we be approaching potentially a moment or a switchover point where it begins to act as a vacuum as opposed to a blower of support into the system?
Well, basically everything I know about passive, I learned from Mike Green.
Our interview with Bill will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our new practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Bill for free, just go to wealthion.com/AdamsNotes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook Bill has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no-strings-attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks Bill has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Bill Fleckenstein.